If I asked you how many subscriptions you have, would you be able to list all of them and how much you're paying? If you would have asked me this question before I started using Rocket Money, I would have said yes. But let me tell you, I would have been so wrong. I can't believe how many I had and all the money I was wasting. Rocket Money is a personal finance app that finds and cancels your unwanted subscriptions, monitors your spending, and helps lower your bills. Rocket Money has over 5 million users and has helped save its members an average of $720 a year with over 500 million in canceled subscriptions. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Cancel your unwanted subscriptions by going to rocketmoney.com/wondery. That's rocketmoney.com/wondery. rocketmoney.com/wondery.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now, imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. So start getting your best night's sleep in sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. And you can try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, 15% off your first order with code WONDERY. So head to BOLLandBranch.com today. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
From 30 Rockefeller Plaza in New York City, please enjoy this podcast edition of Late Night with Seth Meyers. Today, you'll hear a closer look. Then Seth interviews CNN's Reza Aslan, who sticks around for a bonus chat backstage. Now, let's get to the show.
This was supposed to have been the week Donald Trump got a fresh start as president, but now he's facing major new questions about his campaign's alleged contacts with Russia. For more on this, it's time for a closer look. Obviously, Donald Trump got off to a rough start as president, but he finally had what many pundits considered a good day on Tuesday with his first address to Congress. The speech got glowing reviews from the media, and Trump was finally able to reset the narrative as his presidency. And you know what? I have been hard on him, but I think it's only fair that we take a minute to celebrate. In fact, I got some balloons right here, and I'm going to start blowing them up to celebrate the fact that Trump finally has everything under control.
We're back now with our breaking news. Attorney General Jeff Sessions, when he was still a senator and an advisor to the Trump campaign, had meetings with Russia's ambassador to the U.S., but did not disclose them during his confirmation hearings.
Leading Democrats, including House Minority Leader Nancy Pelosi and Senator Elizabeth Warren, are calling for Sessions to resign.
Too. So obviously the timing of this latest bombshell was not good for the White House as they were trying to enjoy the success of Trump's speech on Tuesday. In fact, Team Trump was so happy that the staff's post-speech euphoria drove the decision to put off unveiling the new executive order on migrant travel. For once, we had the wind at our sails, a top aide said. We decided not to on ourselves. Well, it turns out when you eat KFC and Taco Bowls, that decision isn't always up to you. Today, Trump went to Virginia to speak aboard a new aircraft carrier named after former President Gerald Ford. And if he was hoping the appearance would shift the narrative away from the Sessions story, I'm not sure he succeeded. In fact, as usual, Trump seemed just slightly out of his element aboard the ship.
The soon-to-be commissioned Gerald R. Ford, USS, what a place. It's almost, it really feels like a place. You stand on that deck and you feel like you're standing on a very big piece of land, but this is better than land.
Now that may have sounded asinine, but those are actually the words to the Navy fight song. What a place. It really feels like a place. You stand on that deck and you feel like you're standing on a very big piece of land. But this is better than land. Go, Navy! So, turns out, Trump's attorney general, who was also a former advisor to his campaign, as well as the first person in the Senate to declare support for Trump, met with the Russian ambassador while Russia was also allegedly engaged in a campaign of cyber attacks to interfere in the election. Now, this is problematic for a number of reasons. For one thing, Sessions was asked about this very topic under oath during his Senate confirmation hearing and gave an answer that now looks like it was false.
If there is any evidence that anyone affiliated with the Trump campaign communicated with the Russian government in the course of this campaign, what will you do?
Senator Franken, I'm not aware of any of those activities. I have been called a surrogate at a time or two in that campaign, and I did not have communications with the Russians.
Of course, at the time, it seemed believable enough. Surely a senator from Alabama named Jefferson Beauregard Sessions would remember meeting some Russians. Now, we don't get a lot of Ruskies down to this neck of the woods. Can I get you some lemonade? You must be awfully hot underneath that big old furry hat. Now, today, Sessions announced that he will recuse himself from any investigation into contacts between Trump campaign aides and Russian officials. But when the news broke last night, Sessions' office in the White House issued a series of contradictory statements that, in classic Trump fashion, did absolutely nothing to clear things up. First, Sessions' spokeswoman confirmed that he met with the Russian ambassador, but claimed he did it not as a Trump campaign advisor, but as a senator.
This is what a spokesperson for the Attorney General put out in his statement just a short time ago. And I'll read here. There was absolutely nothing misleading about his answer. He was asked during the hearing about communications between Russia and the Trump campaign, not about meetings he took as a senator and as a member of the Armed Services Committee.
You see, honey, I slept with that other woman as accountant Mike, not as your husband Mike. It's totally different. Also, it should be noted that Franken asked Sessions if he knew of anyone in the Trump campaign speaking with Russians, and Sessions went out of his way to mention he worked for Trump's campaign and he didn't talk to the Russians. That's like your wife asking, do you think our son has a drug problem? And you say, no, and I don't either. It's suspicious. So that was the first statement Sessions' office issued. Then a White House official told CNBC the meeting involved only superficial comments about election-related news. That was then followed by a third statement from Sessions himself, which said, I never met with any Russian officials to discuss issues of the campaign. I have no idea what this allegation is about. It is false. I met with him, but I don't know what you're talking about. We discussed the election, but we didn't. It was normal for me to meet with him, but everything you're saying is false. I guess we shouldn't be surprised, since leprechauns always talk in riddles. What's like a piece that moves on land, but it's bigger than land? Now, today, Sessions said he did not recall discussing the election with the Russian ambassador, but one of their meetings occurred on September 8th, the day after a nationally televised candidate forum on NBC, where Trump made headlines by saying this about Putin.
Well, he does have an 82% approval rating, according to the different pollsters.
Do you want to be complimented by that former KGB officer?
Well, I think when he calls me brilliant, I'll take the compliment, okay? If he says great things about me, I'm going to say great things about him. I've already said he is really very much of a leader. I mean, you can say, oh, isn't that a terrible thing?
Okay, I will. Oh, isn't that a terrible thing? Now, look, there could certainly be legitimate reasons for Sessions to meet with the Russian ambassador. It's the fact that he withheld that information from Congress that's a problem. And it comes after a series of incidents in which Trump officials, like former National Security Advisor Michael Flynn, have been cagey about their contacts with Russians. Just take Trump's former campaign manager Paul Manafort as an example. During the campaign, Manafort was asked directly if Trump had any financial relationship with Russian businessmen, and he was so uncomfortable he couldn't even mumble his way through a convincing answer.
So to be clear, Mr. Trump has no financial relationships with any Russian oligarchs.
That's what he said. That's what I said. That's obviously what our position is.
I think the words you're looking for are humana, 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 humana. Look at him. That's the face you make when your wife snatches away your newspaper and screams, whose earrings are these?
They're mine. I'm in a play and I'm a pirate.
Of course, part of the problem here is that we know very little about Trump's possible ties to Russia, a debate he could settle immediately by releasing his tax returns. Instead, Trump has been just as cagey as the people around him, contradicting himself repeatedly when asked whether he knows or has any relationship with Vladimir Putin.
What exactly is your relationship with Vladimir Putin?
I have no relationship with Putin.
Do you have a relationship with Vladimir Putin, a conversational relationship?
I do have a relationship.
I have nothing to do with Putin. I've never spoken to him.
I spoke indirectly and directly with President Putin, who could not have been nicer.
I have nothing to do with Russia. I told you, I have no deals there.
I was in Moscow a couple of months ago. I owned the Miss Universe pageant.
I don't know Putin.
I have no idea.
Asking, I'm asking
I never
you,
met yeah. Putin. This is not my best friend.
They treated me so great. Putin even sent me a present. Beautiful present with a beautiful note.
And he put so much thought into the note, he even cut all the letters out from different magazines. So touching. So touching. Slid underneath my hotel room door. So now, with all these questions swirling about the Trump campaign's contacts with Russia and the involvement of the attorney general in that investigation, even some Republicans are beginning to call for an independent investigation.
Find a very smart, independent person, put them in charge of the whole project, and say, you know, there are questions here, the country has questions, the media has questions.
There may be nothing there, but if there's something there that the FBI believes is criminal in nature, then for sure you need a special prosecutor.
That's how crazy things are right now. We're not even 6 weeks into the Trump presidency, and people in his own party are already talking about a special prosecutor. It's like you're on a third date with someone, and you're already introducing them to your divorce lawyer. And yet, on the other hand, some of the Republicans in Congress who are supposed to be looking into this matter have already been siding with the White House before the facts are even in. Take House Intelligence Committee Chairman Devin Nunes. The Trump administration recruited him to talk to reporters and debunk the Russia allegations before his committee had even completed that investigation. And earlier this week, when reporters asked him if that was appropriate, his answers were not super convincing.
Why would you agree to talk to reporters at the behest of the White House, knowing that you're still looking into this matter?
Yeah, so that story was a little odd, I thought, because if you asked me to contact the White House and said, hey, could you set me up with somebody at DOD or the intelligence agencies, I would say sure. If the White House asked me to talk to you, would you think that that would be okay or not okay?
What's your response to that?
Well, what's your response to it?
What's your response to that? What's your response to that? You're the congressman. No, you're the congressman. What? You're fake news. You're all fake news. Look, we need a full and independent investigation to get to the bottom of this, and it's clear that Jeff Sessions cannot provide that. Congress needs to get the American people concrete answers, because so far, all we've heard are answers like these.
That's obviously what our position is.
This has been A Closer Look.
Hey, I'm Amber Ruffin.
And I'm Jenny Hagel. Thank you so much for listening to the Late Night with Seth Meyers podcast.
But just one more thing. If you could, please subscribe and rate our podcast.
And review it.
And review it. And then call us and tell us you like us in person. Thank you so much.
Yes, he's a religious scholar and best-selling author. His new show, Believer, premieres March 5th on CNN. Please welcome to the show, Reza Aslan. How are you?
I'm great. How fun is this?
It's really fun to have you here.
I'm such a huge fan of yours.
Thank you. I've been a fan of yours for a very long time as well, and this show is great. You go and you talk to people about their religions all over the world.
Well, I don't talk to them. I actually join them.
I immerse
myself into their communities, do what they do.
I'm glad. I wanted to let you explain this clip from the first episode. This is you go to India.
Yes.
And so is the Aghori. They are a...
They're a 500-year-old sect of Hinduism. They reject concepts of purity and pollution. And so the way that they prove that is by taking part in these kinds of, theatrical displays of self-pollution.
Gotcha. And so they covered you. Is it in this clip you're covered in human ashes?
I'm covered in the ashes of the dead, yes.
Okay.
That's right. Yeah.
And this interaction did not go great. You were talking to someone and he did not seem to like the questions.
Not a fan of my questions. No,
let's show a clip real quick because I'm very impressed at how you keep your cool.
Like, this may have been a mistake. Maybe we just, like, somebody distracts him and then I just leave.
So, did they all go like that, or were there some where you stayed?
There were easier interviews
than that
interviews.
One.
You know, what's funny is that the director there, Ben Salkow, afterwards said, I thought you were kidding. And I was like, no. And I realized we don't have a safe word.
Right.
On the show. Like, we have to come up with a word that I can use that says, no, really, get me out of here.
Yeah, but also do research and make sure that the safe word in that religion doesn't mean something completely right. different.
Very good point. Very good point.
But the truth is that, you know, what the belief is kind of remarkable. You know, Hinduism in many ways is obsessed with issues of purity and pollution. And of course, a great part of the caste system in a lot of Indian society is predicated on you know, how polluted you are as an individual. And what the Aghori do by rejecting that notion is that their argument is that there is no caste system. Like, nothing should separate us. And so, yes, some of them take part in these displays where they do things like, for instance, eat dead people.
Uh-huh.
And others express their faith by opening orphanages or taking care of leprosy patients. So there is something really beautiful about the belief system itself.
And in general, is it safe to say that what you're finding of these very disparate religions is how much is similar at the core of all of them?
I mean, I don't want to sound like, you know, too floofy or anything, but I mean, if you spend enough time studying the religions of the world, if you immerse yourself in these different faith communities, you can't help but recognize how beyond, you know, the external stuff, the myths and the metaphors, that ultimately the faith that is being expressed is similar, it's familiar, that really there is so much more that connects individuals across religions than that actually divides them.
That's a very important message right now, which is why I'm very glad that you're doing this show. One thing that's interesting to me is obviously you're seeing people do strange things, like rubbing the ashes of the dead on their face. But you must look so strange to them when you show up and you've got a guy with a boom mic and another guy with a camera.
Right.
How have people responded to you sort of showing up with your film crews?
I mean, that's a very good question, because a lot of these communities are insular. Some of them are, you know, kind of secretive. They're not all that friendly to outsiders in general, let alone, you know, people showing up with a camera crew.
Mm-hmm.
But I find that when you convince someone that their beliefs matter, that you're not there to judge them, that you're not there to make some kind of, you know, value judgment or to mock them, then they open up completely. And sometimes it was easier than others. We do an episode on the ultra-Orthodox Jews in Israel, and, you know, these are people, they don't even like other Jews.
Right.
And here I am, like, you know, a Muslim guy from Iran being like, hey, can I hang out? And so it was hard. It was difficult. But I think the important thing is that when people feel as though you value their beliefs, they're open to sharing those beliefs with you. And the access that we got to a lot of these communities was truly remarkable.
I think, you know, and you saying they have to trust you, because I believe religions, religious people, and I think to some degree they have a point to worry that they're going to be mocked. And I think you do a lovely job of the show of being open to listening to everything they have to say. Of course, not just mockery, but religions are under siege in a lot of different ways right now. You moved from Iran in the 80s to the United States. That was another time of real anti-Muslim sentiment. Do you see parallels right now?
No, everything's great now.
Okay, good.
Yeah, it's all...
I'm so glad. I was so worried you were going to be worrisome.
No, it's
great.
All solved.
Okay, good.
No, I mean, it is funny. I came here during the Iran hostage crisis, so this was a time in which, I was just a 7-year-old kid, but it was an enormous amount of anti-Muslim and anti-Middle Eastern sentiment. I was called, you know, terrorist and raghead and constantly told to go back home, which I thought they meant, like, go back to your apartment.
Sure, yeah.
I was like, okay.
Yeah. I don't love school. I'm out.
Yeah, fine. But I will say this, that although, you know, you hear a lot of those things again today, and it's true that, you know, anti-Muslim sentiment, anti-Semitic sentiment is at unprecedented levels, I think the difference is that when I was a kid, even as a 7-year-old, I understood that I had the Constitution on my side. I understood that no matter what kind of bigotry I was confronted with, that I could rely on, you know, the values and the ideals of the country. It's why we came here. We fled Iran. We could have gone to any country. We picked America because we knew we'd be protected here. And I have to say that what I think worries me is that those underlying values are what is under siege right now. Like, you can't say with the confidence that I had as a kid that, don't worry, the Constitution will protect you. I just can't say that with confidence anymore.
It's interesting. you saying that as a 7-year-old you understood and appreciated the Constitution, there is a thing that people forget about immigrants. Immigrants have, at a much younger age, an appreciation for these things. When I was 7 years old, I wasn't saying, thank God for the Constitution.
Yeah, right.
I was, you know, born here and just took it for granted.
It does change your perspective. I actually, it took me a long time to become a citizen. I became a citizen at the age of 23. And that was a really great experience because I was an adult, and so I understood what was happening. I understood the oath that I was making, the vow that I was making to the United States to protect it from its enemies, foreign or at home. And I also understood the promise that was being made to me, that as long as I accepted these values, these principles as my own, that I am as American as George Washington. I think that's what's beautiful about the American identity. But I also think that in certain times of stress, like we're facing right now, it becomes hard to have, you know, unanimity about what those values actually mean. And unfortunately, so often, the easiest way to define yourself is in opposition to another. I think a lot of people right now are having a hard time saying what it means to be American, but it's pretty easy to say what it doesn't mean, right? It means not being an immigrant, not being a Mexican, not being Jewish, not being Muslim, not being trans. And that's a destructive way of thinking. It's not what this country is predicated upon. We are a country that finds its unity in its diversity, and we need to be proud of that. We need to shout it from the rooftops.
Well, I couldn't agree with you more. Thank you for what you do, and I really think it's the perfect time for your show. It would be nice for all of us to have a little bit more respect for what everybody feels and believes. So, such a pleasure having you here. Give it up for Reza Aslan, everybody.
The legal premieres March 5th on CNN.
Hey everybody, this is Henry from Late Night and backstage with Reza Aslan. Reza, thank you so much for being here.
Thanks, you've got
this great show on CNN where you travel the world and immerse yourself with different religions. You were just talking to Seth about your experience in India with the Aghori. Are there other experiences from traveling the world that kind of stand out to you from your journeys?
Yeah, I mean, there were so many incredible experiences that I had. I think, you know, getting audited. I sort of immersed myself in Scientology for a little while, and the experience of kind of being there and holding the cans and doing that thing, you know, that seems so mysterious and weird and controversial. That was an interesting experience. Probably one of the best experiences I had, though, was in Haiti. I was in the middle of a 10-hour voodoo ritual, which it was, I mean, you know, the banging of the drums and the chanting and the dancing and the dust and you know, people next to me getting possessed by spirits. And then all of a sudden they bring in, you know, this goat, and they you know, cut its neck and then have me drink the blood, and everything was happening so fast. And the next thing you know, somebody hands me this chicken, and great, I was like, sure. What do you want me to do with the chicken? And they're like, you know, kill the chicken. And I was like, I don't know how to kill chickens. Like, that's not my experience. That's not how I grew up, like, knowing how to kill a chicken. So they're like, just grab it by the neck and spin it around, and the neck will snap. So I was like, all right, I'm here to do what you tell me to do. So I grab the chicken by the neck and I start swinging it as fast as I can, but I'm not holding on tight enough. So the head is just spinning in my head. So basically, like, twirling a chicken for like a good minute.
Not what they want.
Wondering like why this thing won't die. But, you know, it was things like that, you know, the experiences like that that really made it one of the most extraordinary experiences of my life doing this show.
You've described your work as kind of a religion translator. Can you explain that?
Well, I think of religion as a language. Mm-hmm. It's a language that's made up of symbols and metaphors. And the purpose of it is to essentially give people, a means of talking to each other and to themselves about this kind of ineffable, mysterious thing called faith.
Right.
And I guess I just see my role as a kind of language translator. You know, my job is to essentially show people, to translate religions for other people, to let them realize that, look, we may call God by different names, we may read different scriptures, we may believe in different myths and follow different rituals, but underneath it all is a sentiment, is an emotion that is, you know, similar if not identical. And I think that that's always been my goal, is to show the binds that connect us across different religious lines.
Right. So we understand each other's religions in the larger sense, but the smaller case language, it can be harder to understand.
Right. Like, for instance, and by the way, when I say it's a language of metaphors, I really mean it.
Yeah,
there's no other way to, if you believe in God, let's say you do believe in God, then, you know, how do you talk about something that is so beyond human comprehension? You need to speak about it in metaphors. And if you understand the metaphors, then they make sense, like any language would. You know, if I said to someone, I've been washed by the blood of the Lamb. If you know what that metaphor means, let's say you are, you know, a faithful, devout Christian, and you understand what I mean by that, which is that my sins have been cleansed by Jesus' death, then you and I shared a very powerful emotional moment with each other. If you don't speak that language, it sounds like the craziest thing you've ever heard in your life. Like, wait, what? Like,
why would you do that?
Yeah, you bathed it in lamb's blood? Why? Why would you do that?
Yeah.
So that's it. It's about, you know, the linguist who translates languages to people, helps them understand each other. That's how I see my role.
Yeah. Speaking of your roles, best-selling author, religious scholar, now a host on CNN. I read this online. You had a breakdancing career or hobby?
True story. So I came to the U.S. in 1979, grew up in the 1980s. This was not a good time to be Muslim in America. And so I just told everybody that I was Mexican. I kind of looked Mexican, you know. I knew a little bit of Spanish. I lived in a neighborhood full of a lot of Mexican immigrants. And so I was just like, orale, I'm Mexican. Which, very important, did not help, by the way. Did not deter. Sure. Yeah, I did not understand America well enough to know that Americans are also not all that fond of Mexicans, as well as Muslims. Right. But nevertheless, and so part of my, like, going undercover was I joined a breakdancing troupe. We were called El Norte. My nickname was El Penguin because I am so extremely...
The penguin
because I'm so extremely bow-legged. I was like, no one... I mean, who can hate a Mexican breakdancer?
Very, very, very few people. Reza, thank you so much for being here. Such a pleasure.
Thanks, Henry. Awesome. I really appreciate it. Thank you.
So great.
Want more Late Night with Seth Meyers? Be sure to follow the handle at Late Night Seth on Facebook, YouTube, Twitter, Instagram, and Snapchat. You can also watch full episodes of Late Night at LateNightSeth.com or on the NBC app. And please tell your friends who are fans of Seth Meyers to subscribe to the podcast on iTunes.
1, 2, 3, 4. Those are numbers, but you already knew that. If you want to know what number you're going to pay each month for your car, use Kelley Blue Book My Wallet on AutoTrader. They're really good at numbers. AutoTrader.